0. It's Radio Zero with Rick and Rose and our very special guest, Jonas Downey.
Yeah, so like we said before, we're going to try to start bringing in guests more frequently or again.
It was like we've had Ian MacKay on here. We've had Steve Albini.
Yeah, 15 years ago. We've had guests on since then.
Alex Borstein.
That's true.
A long time ago.
Yeah, so you're in good company, Jonas.
Yeah, they're in good company.
So I'm going to introduce Jonas. And then we're going to start talking about some stuff. All right. Jonas Downey grew up in Champaign, Illinois, where he built his first website in 1996 with Netscape and a dial-up modem. He has a BS in Computer Science and Mathematics from the University of Illinois and an MFA in New Media from the U of I.
Wait, I contest that. It's narrative media, right?
Yeah, you can call it
you and I are narrative media. He's new
right.
media.
Yeah.
We were the
I changed
first.
It because nobody knows what nobody narrative knows media what, is.
Nobody yeah. knows. Yeah. Okay. All right.
From 2006 to 2011, he led web development for the Advanced Photon Source at Argonne National Laboratory and designed a complete overhaul of the main Argonne website. And so, again, a tangent. Both my father and my uncle worked at Argonne. So it's crazy. Going through this bio. it's like how much we all have in common is scary.
Oh, that's so nice.
He's a co-creator of Hello Weather, regularly one of the top weather apps in the App Store. And in 2011, he joined Basecamp as a product designer. He worked on all of Basecamp's products over the next decade, including Basecamp 2 and 3, Know Your Company, and especially Hey, a redesigned rethinking of email, which I would love to talk to you about, but I think that would require a whole nother episode. Maybe we can talk a little bit about it.
Yeah.
This year, he left Basecamp after almost 10 years at the company and 2 years leading the design team and is currently figuring out what to do next. Welcome to Radio Zero, Jonas.
Thank you all for having me on. This is amazing.
Yay. Yeah, so we've known Jonas for a very long time, longer than we all want to admit, right? Are you at that point yet, Jonas, where you don't like to do the math on how long you've known someone?
Yes, I've been reflecting on just how long I've been doing my career, and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
It's been some time.
Yeah, 25 years,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
20 plus years. Okay, so I thought I'd start off. This is going to be a lot of Rick talking, but then hopefully I'll stop talking.
Which is very unusual for Radio Zero.
Yes. So for folks who don't know what Basecamp is, it's a company that designs web-based project management tools, among other things, and it's well known as having a substantial remote workforce. And recently at Basecamp, there was an issue with societal and political discussions on internal forums at the company. Basically, they were forbidden, and employees were given a chance to leave if they didn't like the new policy. So, Jonas, you left the company recently, and out of respect to you and any agreements around your leaving, we're not going to talk in detail about what happened and why you left, but I thought it'd be a good opportunity to have you on the show and talk in general about remote work environments, social responsibility, and work life versus personal life. Okay, so maybe we can start with that idea. I think we're all dealing with this blurring of lines, what used to be work talk and what used to be private talk, or all of that is kind of changing and merging. And I guess, yeah, just the big question is what do you feel about that? And kind of how, what do you think about that idea of this idea of work talk and other talk, especially in a world where we're all kind of communicating in these remote environments nowadays?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a very nuanced, complicated issue with a whole lot of parts to it. So part of the challenge of this is like the media reporting of it and the headline you read is like, no politics at work, right? That's like the sort of 50-foot view of it. And that's not actually what I think is going on in most cases. It kind of sounds like work discussions have devolved into like angry Thanksgiving dinners with your family where like people are fighting over literal politics, like who they're voting for and what's happening in the election and whatever. And I don't think that that's actually going on all that much at companies, because most people are relatively conscientious that like you probably don't want to get into that in like a large group setting. I mean, you don't even really want to get into it at Thanksgiving. So I don't you know, so if you read the headline, it sounds like, oh, well, actually that seems kind of reasonable because who would want that, right?
Right.
But so what I think is actually happening is something that's more subtle, and the headline sort of oversimplifies what it is. And so my opinion, what is happening is that companies are becoming more engaged in diversifying their hiring pipelines, because they've kind of recognized that doing that has all sorts of theoretical benefits from kind of an operational and like an HR PR standpoint. But they're not following through on that by adjusting the working environments to like accommodate those people once they've brought them in. And so I think the whole politics at work thing is actually more a matter of like internal power dynamics at a company. Like if you bring in a diverse workforce world in different ways and comes at it from a lot of different viewpoints, how do you engage them and have discussions that are safe and make people feel like their voices are heard and that they're able to affect change at the company that they care about? So that I think is kind of the root of the challenge. And it's not like, there's not like an easy solution to that. It's like, this is going to be pretty hard work. So you can say, we're just going to ban the political talk, but I think it's like a very, very blunt hammer to deal with a nuanced problem. It's kind of my opinion.
Yeah. So it's not just these random conversations. They're conversations about the work environment and how to make it a place where not only you're trying to create a diverse work environment, but you're also trying to have people stay. And so what's interesting is we're having the same discussions in academia and our side.
Yeah.
And it's like, we have a lot of talk about diversity and inclusion and equitable hiring and all that kind of stuff. But then it's like, but what about retention? And also about students, retention. You know, it's like, once we start diversifying here, then how are we going to actually make people feel like they're part of the system or organization or community, right?
Right. Yeah, it takes a sort of high-level awareness of that being a challenge and saying, we're going to be really open-minded and we're going to have to listen a lot and hear some stuff that maybe is hard to hear and slow down and be willing to change a little bit. But like, if you care about that and you actually want to make it a good environment for everyone, that's sort of how you have to go into it.
You're talking about that in lower education too, right? I mean, having problems with that, with just, you know, the new culturally responsible teaching and stuff like that, right? I just read a story about, like, I think on WGLT today, you know, that it's being challenged, right? Like,
right, but so we could talk about the kind of external societal, you know, just challenges to those ideas, but I think what we're talking about is, and this is what comes up with academia, is like you're in an environment that seems to be really invested in diversity, right? And making progress there. It's not an argument of whether or not we should do that. It's like, yeah, we should do that. And it sounds like that's been Jonas's experience. This is where we're talking about this. This is part of our mission statement or whatever, right? Is diversity and inclusion. And then so we're not even arguing those larger scale societies arguments about, oh, should we be doing that? I think people are on board, but then that's where the real work comes in, where it's like, oh, but yeah, we've said, oh, let's open the doors. But then how are you welcoming? How are you supporting? How are you nurturing, right, your workforce? And do you need to adapt, right? It's not simply enough to say, oh, we're going to be diverse. It's like, oh, what does that actually mean for the company? And what does that mean about in terms of day-to-day interaction? So what made me think about what I originally was thinking is that some of these issues maybe that you were encountering because if you're in an online work environment, a remote work environment, everything's kind of documented, you know, in news groups, right? And so you have this kind of idea of, you know, a chat room, right? Like, it's just what I'm imagining. And then people talking about really serious, very specific stuff about workplace environments and how to make it more welcoming and how to make sure people are heard and everything like that. But then I realized, well, no, that's the same kind of conversation. That would be just as difficult a conversation and possibly shut down if it was a in-person conversation. If you were in a in-person meeting, like we were in a conference room and somebody started talking about this, and then someone in leadership said, this is not the place for these discussions. Yeah, so I was going to ask you if it, do you think some of this is because we've moved online and a lot of work culture is now in this online setting, but I'm wondering if that's even true.
Yeah, no, I think it is. The reason that it's different, there's actually two reasons. One is that remote tools for work flip the scale dynamic of human communication. So normally, if you're like in an office environment, there's like a few people around you at a time. And like the likelihood that you're talking to like a large group is relatively small. Like you don't do that that often. You might like get up and have a company meeting once every 6 months or something, but you're not usually like shouting from the rooftop to a large group. In chat, that's the default. Like if you show up at work and you're having a bad day and you drop something in like general channel on Slack, like 200 people at your company are going to see that, right? So there's sort of a high likelihood of mistakes and people, you know, maybe putting conversations in places that like all the participants aren't ready for that or whatever. And so like, I think the tooling is sort of inadequate at this point. We basically have like reduced all human communication into like two-dimensional channels that are like Slack and Zoom. Like those are our choices if we're going to be like a remote workforce right now. And they're not quite nuanced enough, or they're not like intentionally designed enough to accommodate this degree of challenging conversation, unless the company has been thoughtful about it and has said like, we do want people to talk and we do want to support everyone and have lots of spaces for that, but there's certain spots you're going to go and like, you know, don't be dropping things in like the 2000 person general channel, whatever, you know. And those are hard decisions to make, and there's no easy answers. So like, even if you have guidelines or something, people are going to mess up. Humans are messy. There's going to be stuff. But I think that we definitely are in like a challenging situation where it's like easy to get into trouble with written communication at scale. And like, that's a new thing that we have to deal with.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So in the same way, kind of like societal hierarchy is being challenged by, you know, everyone having a platform, right? Social media, same thing's happening in the workplace environment. Whereas before it would have been, you know, the administration. And again, I'm thinking more academically, but like, yeah, administration and then maybe memos or, you know, certain meetings where you had a whole, well, actually, yeah, just managerial hierarchy, right? And so that filters the ability for people to sort of jump layers or communicate across.
Reply all, as it were.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas, and like chat tools don't have any hierarchy to them, really. Like an employee who just came in, like an intern, has the same degree of like noise to signal as like the CEO of the company, because they're both just chatting in the same environment. So it kind of upends a lot of the like traditional ways that people would be communicating normally if they were in a room together, or if they were in a company that was like old school and maybe only sent email. You know, it's like that sort of communication is much more thoughtful. It's long form, it's slower. I think this is definitely contributing to like part of the challenge. And then on top of that, you've got the last couple of years of total global upheaval in like 15 different ways that is like stressing everyone out and putting pressure on them, and they're having to work in new ways they've never had to do, and they're having personal horrible things happen to them. And so like the tension is also very high. So you've got like easy places to talk that maybe could mess things up, and you've got people under stress. And so like it's hard. Like it's definitely a thing that companies are having to figure out how to navigate. It's not easy.
So that's actually kind of my next question. That's a great lead-in, is that, so you worked at a company that was, you know, online web applications that are, you know, sort of about company productivity and management, project management, I would say, but then also was a real proponent of remote workforces and a remote work environment. And so you have an experience, at least a decades long experience working in that type of environment. And then I guess the question is what did it feel like, or did you learn anything new when basically everyone last year wound up working remotely, right? And had to experience that change in a day or two or a week, you know, in March, right?
Right.
Whereas you kind of had been swimming in that for 10 years. Was that a situation where it was just kind of like, okay, now everyone's going to understand what I've dealt with and the problems, but also the positives? Or were there some things that you learned once everyone else kind of was swimming in the same thing, and it became, rather than this kind of radical idea of work, to becoming the at least temporary normal of work.
Yeah, it was interesting to watch that play out. I think we had been running a company that was very intentionally kind of designed around the idea of doing remote work as like remote first. Whereas companies that came to it because they were forced to from the pandemic came at it from a very different angle. It was like, well, we used to operate one way and now we can't, so we'll just do kind of what we were doing, except we'll use like video chat instead. Like it was like sort of how people transitioned to it. Which, you know, I haven't actually heard as many like horror stories from doing that as I would have expected. That like you would think that it would have just been like a complete like disaster for everyone to try to just like completely change their operational mode like almost at once. It seems like a lot of companies kind of figured it out, which maybe tells the tale that this whole idea that like remote work is some like renegade, you know, amazing idea that only a few people can pull off is actually kind of flawed. Like, yeah, everyone can do it if you want to. It's a matter of just like caring about it and taking the time to figure it out. I think it was interesting to see people switch to tons of meetings. I think like Zoom became the thing. And at Basecamp, we were never very like video meeting heavy. We're very much more about like long form writing. So our style was like, if you're gonna do any communication, it's gonna be in Basecamp probably, you're gonna write something up, you're gonna do comments, to-dos, chat, whatever. And then fall back to video as like sort of a last resort. Like it's like, okay, well, we can't figure it out by just writing things to each other. So let's like get on a call and do something higher fidelity. Seems like companies are doing every variation of that. So some have a mix and some are mostly chat and some are mostly video, and it's just all over the map.
Yeah, that's great. Maybe how does like, so because you've had this experience over the years, what do you see are some of the, well, so obviously everybody kind of knows the positives, which is that, you know, when you're, well, now everybody knows, right, is that, oh, you have a more flexible schedule, right, unless you're in a company that's doing like what you're saying, which is, oh, they just replaced regular meetings with Zoom meetings, and so you're expected to be on Zoom from 8 to 5, right?
Right.
Which,
yeah.
But for everybody else and people I've talked to, it's like, oh, wait a minute, I can get a lot of work done at home. I'm more productive. My staff is more productive. I think there's been a lot of publicity about those kind of positives because that's the kind of arguments that are made when before this happened, when people talked about a remote workforce. What are some of the pitfalls? Like maybe some of these things, some of these issues that we were talking about previously. I mean, does And what are some of the pitfalls of this remote workforce stuff in terms of those are the common criticisms, is there's a lack of connection, being, you know, sort of having those one-on-one and just kind of informal encounters with, you know, co-workers and the conversations around the water cooler type things. I mean, what are the pitfalls that you kind of notice from your sort of longer term experience with this model?
Yeah, I think so the downside of remote work is that it sort of shifts a lot of responsibility on individuals to figure out how to kind of remain like personally healthy with their relationship with work. Because the primary issue is that like your work is always available to you in the same setting that the rest of your life is available to you, right? Like you are working from your house and your kids are in your house and you're doing everything in one place and you don't, there's no like 9 to 5 clock in and clock out. It's like, you can just keep open the computer and you're working. So that alone is a challenge that like you have to become more disciplined about how you separate yourself when you're working, when you're not, how you're clear about like, I'm offline and I'm not going to go back online. It's like, you need to develop like a discipline around that. And then secondly, it is isolating. It just is, there's not really much other way to say it. You know, for most of the years that I worked at Basecamp, I could commute into our office. We had a little office in Chicago and I could go in. So I did. I would go in, you know, 1 or 2 days a week. And that was super helpful. Like that was part of the reason I liked it, was that I could get a little bit of FaceTime, but then the rest of the week I was like on my own schedule and being productive, building stuff that I wanted to do. So that to me actually feels like the healthiest balance, is like having a little bit of human connection somehow, whether it's a co-working space or an office or something. And then the rest of the time being kind of free, because then it's more productive. It's like you schedule all your meetings for that 1 or 2 days when you're together, and then the rest of the time you're off doing stuff, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, and these types of, like, the FaceTime meetings, I mean, actual in-person meetings and stuff, I think, what was I going to say about this? I was just talking about having, like, moving my office down to the area where all the other people on my level talk, and, like, they just walk back and forth, you know, this, like, the main floor where people are going to the water cooler or whatever, and but most of the people, I'm new in administration now, sort of, like, half administration, and all the administrators are down at this same level. So I just running into one of the, you know, the director of the School of Art yesterday, and we had like an hour long just chat about a whole bunch of different things, and these are like just happenstance meetings. And I remember first learning about this, you know, when they were talking about building the Beckman Institute, right? And there was people were up in arms about, you know, we should have unisex bathrooms because all the dudes are going to talk in the men's bathroom and the women are not going to be privy to those, you know, conversations. And so I remember I remember a bunch of people talking about that, and I was new to all this, and I was like, wow, they're right, kind of, you know?
Yeah. Designing buildings, in fact, for collaboration, like making sure that they have common spaces where people run into each other so that they aren't able to self-isolate or create pockets.
So, you know, I'm going to totally throw a wrench into all this. This is freaking me out because, you know, one of the things that I've been writing about is the concept of tangents back in Usenet news groups, where, you know, the Usenet news group was supposed to be about was supposed to be about soap operas or something like that, and then somebody will start writing about something completely different. My cat died, and then everybody will come in and talk about that or something like that, and that's a tangent, and that's supposed to build community, right? So I don't know, you know, you're too young to have been on Plato, but that type of stuff, we talk about that all the time, like our physics classes, you know, we're on Plato on this
computer system.
Yeah. And
I'm actually not too young for that.
You had played. Yeah. Okay. All right. Cool. Amazing. In high school. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
but people, you know, people, I talk about the concept of, you know, people just, you know, having an area for people to just write whatever they want. And then we got Nancy Baim, you know, who's from U of I, who's a researcher who talks about this type of stuff. And I know I know other people also have talked about this, but just the concept of being able to have these other types of discussions in these spaces builds community. And so what you're talking about now is freaking me out, because I'm like, yes, they're all great. Tangents are great. People being able to talk about other things other than the directed work topic is great, but it sounds like it isn't.
Yeah. Well, that's actually an interesting point, that like the thing that you miss with doing like video calling is spontaneity. Because like you can't spontaneously bump into people in a video call. It's like it has to be scheduled in advance,
right,
and there's like all this like formality to it. So that's like off. Like it's like you're just not going to get like one-on-one, like tangential conversation in like a high fidelity format over.
And they say this is like digital library versus actual walking around in library, or digital bookstore, Amazon versus walking around in the bookstore, like seeing the books that you weren't searching for.
Right. Yeah. So in a work environment, then the only place where you can have spontaneous conversation like that is in, like you're saying, a message board or a chat, basically, which is great, except that where do you do that then? Like, which is the appropriate forum to have spontaneous conversation? Is it in front of the whole company? Is it like pockets of social groups? Like, is it private chats that are like one-on-one or two-on-one or whatever?
Yeah.
Like, it's you kind of have to choose a space, and like even that sort of reduces spontaneity then, because you've had to make a choice. You've had to say like, well, I'm going to put this here or there.
So
it's definitely a challenge. Like,
contrary to inclusion, right? So people can have their pockets, and like, oh, somebody takes over the off-topic chat area, and then somebody else feels like, oh, I can't talk in here because it feels
that's not for me, right?
So like, totally. if we were in grad school right now, we would have to come up with like an idea, like a digital version of like walking around in the hallways at work and seeing like, oh, I see that person and that person, and you go, hey guys, come here for a second. And then you talk about like something not totally work related, but you know, just those are the people who like you think would be interested in this, in these two topics.
Well, in our work environment, so Slack did not take hold a few years ago. We were trying to get people to adopt Slack, but Discord has seemed to take in more hold because the students are more interested in that. And so it seems like that's starting to happen.
So the game students like the Discord.
The gaming students like the Discord specifically, but then the faculty seem to be slowly being a part of that. And I feel like we're starting to get that conversational stuff happening on Discord, but it is, it's not quite perfect. And it doesn't feel exactly like the informal bumping into each other kind of thing. It's more people make announcements and then it starts a kind of a conversation.
But it's and then certain people don't want to mix their gaming life with the school life too.
Right. Yeah, and then it can get to be chat fatigue also. Like if you overdo it and you make all these like pockets of, oh well, now I got to watch 500 different channels in Discord all day to know if something's happening. You know, it's like, yeah, it's, again, the tools are kind of insufficient. They're like, they're not quite right yet, it seems like.
Yeah, and actually, I was just remembering when you two were kind of talking about this, is that I had been in this workshop, actually a design thinking workshop, kind of randomly with an administrator, and one thing he had said is that, and this was when we were in lockdown, but a few people in the administration were still going into the building, but he had decided he wasn't, and he was not terrified, that's unfair, but he was constantly thinking about what did he miss just by not being in the physical space. And there's also that aspect, like you're talking about, is the fear of missing out, and it becomes not only just simply like, oh, I don't know who the latest pop star is, or I haven't watched this latest viral video or something like that. It's also like, oh, I've missed something important at work because I'm not in that chat, or right, I haven't heard that. And so then you become a consumer of everything, and you have that constant chat notification going off, and it's distracting and overwhelming. Happens to me with even our simple Discord with the faculty. It's all of a sudden, it sparks a huge discussion, and all of a sudden it's like, bam, 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 bam. I mean, I'm trying to do something else, and it's just like, oh, I got to keep track because I don't want to miss out on what everyone's talking about.
Right.
And it's the same people, too. It's like me and this other person, like heart, whatever I've written, you know, and then I'm like, oh, wait, how about this? Because it's the system is designed so that I can just, you know, throw another thing up there. And then you have to realize after a while, okay, this is driving people crazy, and they've probably muted it by now. And then there's too much information.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's maybe I'll kind of step over to the next conversation point, which, Jonas, you have a great website, jonas.do, right? And you've got a list of principles, making respectful products, empowering people, building weird things, standing up for good, leading with care. Number four, standing up for good, fighting harmful practices in tech, calling out dark patterns and bias, protecting privacy, attention, and safety. I think this kind of what we were just talking about is, how do you actually design and think about designing for equity, trying to solve these problems? And then I think some people would say, well, especially web design and development, it's like, well, no, that's just presenting information. That's kind of generic. It's like a library, right? Even though, again, there's a huge amount of like a physical library that you could say, oh, no, there's all sorts of things about why this physical building is, you know,
not DEI compliant.
Yeah, not right. Yeah, not diverse, okay, and not welcoming. So I guess that's a question, is how do you design, standing up for good? How does that translate
Give
into
us examples.
Your design process?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually where this kind of blanket policy thing, I feel like, bumps directly into the work that I care about doing. So I wrote about this recently. So I care about software. I think of it as being human infrastructure in the same way that like cities are human infrastructure. They're like, if you're going to build a highway in a city, you have to think about, where do you put it? And when you put it somewhere, who gets displaced by that highway, and who empowers themselves by having a highway? Who has access to that? Who does not? And then what's the environmental impact? And then what are the things that happen that we didn't even consider when we put it there? You know, So I think of software as being the same thing. Basically, we're building ecosystems that are like access to stuff. It's that they affect people's physical and psychological behavior. And this happens even with software that like you wouldn't think of as being that, right? Like there's so many facets to software, like even just signing up, how you enter your name to sign up for a service can be impactful for people who have names that have different types of formats, whatever. Like computers are not really very good at dealing with human problems. And so humans are good at dealing with human problems, and software designers are humans thinking about humans. So that's kind of how I think about design. I think software doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's a major part of our lives and it's part of our social construct. And so when we're doing software design, we have to think about positive change we want to make, but also negligence we may have had or side effects that are harmful that we may not have thought of. And so in that process, I think the only way to do the best that you can is to have a team that feels safe to raise issues. And some of the issues are going to be societal and political issues. Like they just are. It's going to come up. And so I think you have to have a supportive environment that allows for some of that to happen. And if you've kind of said like, no, we're not going to care about that, or we're not going to talk about it, it's going to reduce your ability to design software. Like it just is, because they're not disentangled things. Like they're part of the same fabric, I think. So I can stop there, but that's kind of my short spiel about this.
So what's interesting now is, now I'm going to play the devil's advocate. And so part of the pushback in this issue of eliminating, you know, political conversations or everything like that was that it's not that we're saying you can't have those conversations. There are other places you can have those conversations, right? So then the question is, maybe, is why does that have to be something that happens within a work environment? Again, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but, it'd be interesting to hear kind of what your feelings are about that. Like, why couldn't you just talk about this somewhere else, right?
Right. Well, so I'll give you kind of a generic example, like generalize a little bit. So let's say you are a software design team, and you are working on a problem, and you've hired some people in who have different backgrounds and different viewpoints, right? Let's say one of the people is transgender. Now, that's good for you as a team, because you're going to have people who see problems in a different way and have experienced things in their lives that affect them differently, which will improve the design. Like software design is only as good as the team that made the software. So like the stronger you have that team and the more representation you have in that team, the better the product will be. Let's say you have a transgender employee who notices something in your software design that's maybe problematic for them. Their entire identity is a little bit political, maybe a lot political. And so should they feel free to raise that concern then? This is directly about the work product. It's not about their, you know, personal politics or anything. It's about work. It's like we're making a design and we're going to try to do our best. Should they feel comfortable to bring that up or not? And in a policy like this, like, would they feel comfortable? I don't know. I actually don't know the answer to that. And I don't know how Basecamp is choosing to implement this exactly. I don't really know. But that's kind of like the way that I come at this, is like, I want to have a team that's able to have those difficult conversations and that people feel free to express something that's concerning to them about the work, because that will create a better design. And it's not always going to be an easy thing to hear. And it's going to be, there's going to be debates and there's going to be maybe heated situations. There's gonna be tension from time to time, but like that's how you work through difficult problems and do something that's good in the end. So that's sort of my motivation as a designer, is like, I care about this stuff, I take it seriously, and like that's the environment I think I need to do it right.
It's interesting, because I feel like good designers have to have a good amount of empathy, right? And be able to see, talk in the way you're talking, right? And say, hey, no, we need to talk about this stuff, and we need to, you know, have all these differing, you know, ideas and have this kind of safe environment to talk about stuff that could be contentious, or some people might interpret as, you know, sort of threatening. It's like, are you saying that I'm not, you know, sympathetic? But then my question is, but there are, I mean, is it, do you think, this is a crazy question, but do you think there are other ways of approaching design that aren't human-centric, right? So I think it could be argued that this idea of human-centered design which makes perfect sense and seems to me to be obvious, but it's a relatively new kind of idea. I don't think it's a new idea. I think previously there was this idea of design similar to engineering, which is that it's a problem that an expert can solve, and you the expert knows better and doesn't really need to talk to the users. And so, yeah, what am I asking? I'm asking, do you think it's possible to design without, talking about these personal and social sort of issues?
Yeah, I mean, you probably can design a process, like a product building process, where like those conversations are sort of abstracted externally, like outside of your team environment. Like one version can be that you have a research team that is sort of deciding in advance what kinds of problems they're going to work on and going out kind of into the field and surveying the entirety of that, and then driving like product strategy around what problems we care about and then how we're kind of going to get into those and what stuff we should focus on. That kind of works, and like it a little bit just punts the problem to a different group. It's kind of like, okay, well, you all make sure that everything that we've decided to do is kind of like okay and checks all of our boxes, and then the designers will just do it. But that to me is not really design at that point. It's sort of just like implementing a strategy. So I think either way, there's no way to like get out of thinking about this, that like it could be the designer's responsibility or someone else's responsibility. At the end of the day, if the product has missed something that's like going to create bias or harm for some subset of the users that are trying to use the product, that's a failing somewhere along the line. And I think personally that the best way to solve that is to have the design team empowered to sort of like notice that, because they're the ones that are closest to actually building the thing. But you know, you do it any number of different ways, I think.
And it makes me realize that all kind of societal interactions, whether they're workplace or public interactions or private interactions, are designed, right? They may be designed in this evolutionary or anarchic way, right? But a lot of times it was existing power structures. And now what's interesting is we have this kind of virtual environment that allows, you know, more people to be involved in the process and to design and very quickly change the way humans interact, right?
Right.
And so So actually thinking about it and being engaged in the process is actually a very powerful role to play. And so instead of being frightened of these sort of difficult discussions, it should be something that a designer would embrace, I would think, because it's representing how much more sort of influence people have now, individuals have, or in, you know, groups of people working have, to kind of sculpt the way our culture operates and interacts with each other.
Yeah, and that's the reason that I care a lot about this, is because, again, it's that scale thing where, you know, in, let's say you're designing a building and you don't put a wheelchair accessible ramp on the building. Like, okay, you now have one inaccessible building that has a problem. But if you build a communications platform that's negligent and inaccessible in certain ways for a subset of your users, you've now multiplied that by potentially tens of thousands or millions of people who now can't do the thing that they need to do. So it's like very easy to sort of cut something along the process of design and say like, well, you know, we only have so much time, we're going to cut this out, or we're not going to do this, we're not going to care about this. But like, that has really serious effects when you multiply it by the exponential use of software at scale. So I think you kind of have to care in a way that you maybe don't as much when you're doing something that's more isolated or more individual. And obviously it also depends on what you're building. But yeah.
And I really loved when you were talking about highways going through cities, because that's the whole Robert Moses sort of scenario, whereas I'm realizing maybe with tech we're in that early era of urban planning like where Robert Moses said, well, a highway is a good thing and new buildings are good things. We're going to run this highway through this neighborhood and not even think about the fact that it's going to isolate a whole population or a whole segment of the population and, you know, undermine their connection to the rest of the city. And it's kind of this overlord kind of view of how to reconfigure our improved society. And that's kind of what we've been going through with this this, you know, 50-year tech digital revolution. And now it's kind of like, well, wait a minute, we're isolating people. We're not thinking about everybody here. In the name of progress, we just kind of accepted these broad strokes, and we haven't actually thought about what a neighborhood is, what a community is. We've just kind of built these structures. And so that I really love that kind of metaphor is that we're moving into an era where we have to be, you know, sort of socially responsible, acknowledge that this technology and these systems that we implement can have huge impacts on the way people sort of live and survive and feel engaged.
Yeah, there's so much tension in it that like there's like a business aspect to it too, where a lot of the stuff that we use currently, like Facebook or Twitter, YouTube, whatever, was driven a lot by business interests and trying to like collect attention and collect people as much as possible. And like everything that you design when you're doing that has two sides. It's like, is it benefiting a company or is it benefiting people and society and people using the tool? And you have to, as a designer, constantly weigh those concerns and be like, well, okay, like we're going to make these trade-offs in order to make money, but we're going to also make these trade-offs that don't make us money, but that we care about because it's like the ethical thing to do. So it's like, everything is blurry. There's like no easy answer to anything when you're working on these problems. You need a team that's like very aware of this.
So I remember in some of the research that I've been doing, it was like about a year ago, so I can't remember, but there's a consultants who would help you make your website so that people's eyes would stay on it. And this is how you can keep people addicted to your website or to your apps or whatever. And then that same consulting company was also helping people disengage from too much internet too. So I thought that was
amazing. So they helped people create the problem, and then they could also help people
disengage.
Solve the problem. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, that's a good summary of the software industry in general.
Right.
It's like, how can we make money on both ends? Yeah.
You guys are talking about urban planning, and I love that you're talking about urban planning as a metaphor for software development. And it's just, you know, we all came from the same narrative/new media program, and I'm just wondering if it's just wonderful to have had urban planning and landscape architecture within a fine arts, in the same silo as all the fine arts.
Yeah, and that leads into the kind of free-for-all area, the fun nostalgia part of the conversation, but not just nostalgia, just talking about our kind of common experience with all three of us being computer scientists and then moving into a fine arts program, new media, narrative media. And so for you, what benefits are there for you to have been that kind of dual personality, right? Talking a little bit about that, and then I'm sure we can start reminiscing.
Yeah, I don't know. I've reflected back on that time a lot, and like why I made these weird decisions that I made about what I would go into and like what I studied, because it doesn't make a lot of sense like in retrospect. Like I went into college and studied computer science, and then kind of realized like halfway through it that I'm like, I don't really want to do programming. Like it's like my job. It's like, I don't like programming enough to only do that. And then went to art school, which had like no obvious purpose. I mean, I guess art school doesn't in principle, it doesn't necessarily have an obvious purpose, but it was like a gamble. It was like a brand new program. We had no idea really what it was. It was like, I don't know. Yeah, that seems like definitely what I should be doing. But I think what happened was that the computer science thing messed up my brain in a way. I became like much more logical and like computational in the way that I thought of problems. And then going to art school like flipped that on its head and said like, okay, now you know how to think of things computationally, but like, why are you doing any of this? And like, what are you trying to say when you do that? And like, how are you using these tools to get the results that you want? And so the combination of that was like two resets of my head. Like it was like, first learn a new way to do things and then totally change it again. And so when I think I came out of it with like understanding that I don't know anything at the end, like I'm probably wrong a lot. And so like, that's the way I approach almost all of my work is like, I'm probably wrong and I need to think of this a lot of different ways. And I think like that's maybe the summary that I came out of. aside from just like the technical skills and stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That kind of like self-critical narrative in your head where it's like being able to accept that you might be wrong or that you don't necessarily have all the answers and you don't have the perfect solution and you have to explore and iterate and everything like that. And that really distills a lot of the frustration I have maybe with people who are really, really smart and are very capable, but sometimes they don't understand that there are other concepts, solutions, or they may not be 100% correct in their solution, right? They don't have that access to the questioning part, right? Because they're invested in authority. Fascinating. Because, yeah, I always think about computer programming, like learning how to program as being, it programs you, right? Your mind does,
totally.
You get rewired. Yeah. But I did not think about the arts as part of that rewiring, right? So the flip side, and I'm fascinated about that. I want to hear more about that because I don't fully... And I don't know if you can answer more about it. I think your answer was great, but when you hear that, do you feel that way too? That the art experience, the sort of that we collectively went through, had like can,
I'm
yeah.
I'm astounded by both you guys because both you guys knew more about art when you entered that program than I did. I have a very classical background in art, which was, you know, my dad telling me to take out the Renoir books from my grade school library. And then we would look at how they'd, it's beautiful. It doesn't look like a photograph because it's paint. So, you know, when I first entered narrative media, I was like, well, I already know how to do all this digital art stuff. So I know how to make things look really beautiful. So I'm probably going to get an A and they'll probably let me through. Like I didn't even realize I must not have known anything about conceptual art at all. And now I know all about it.
I definitely did not. Yeah. Like, I don't think I even realized that's what I was getting into.
Yeah. No, I didn't either.
Wait, what am I doing?
That first thing I did, like I took a video of water with light shining on it. And it was, you know, with my handheld video camera. And then I brought it in to show. It was the first thing, you know, bring in one thing that you did the first day of class, you know, when our beloved instructor was like, everybody needs to make a lot of shit before they do something good. And I was just like, what do you mean? This looks beautiful. And it's a sea and Buddha and, you know, all this stuff. Look, I've tied it into religion, you know, which I learned, you know, a couple of years into it that you don't do that because that's real obvious and trite, contrite. Where was I going with all this? But so I'm like, you guys are way more advanced in art than I am. When I got into narrative media and I learned that I learned about art with a capital A instead of with the little a, I guess, you know, I'm so thankful of everything that I learned. I'm so thankful of being in the, watching that. I don't even remember what girl this was. I don't know if you guys were in this crit with me. But the girl who kept coming, the glass girl who's making glass stuff, she kept coming in every 3 weeks she'd have a crit. You know, she'd be on the hot spot. She'd be like, I'm still researching. Look, I researched bodies. And I'd be like, oh my God, somebody's going to yell at her at the end of this. She's just researching, you know, and I researched the circulatory system this week, you know, this for this last 3 weeks. And then like it went on for the whole year. And then by the end of the year, she's like, well, I have my project, you know, it's, we have to come visit it in my studio. And when I came in and it was like an exploded body. It was like all, do you guys remember this? She had made out of glass. She had made all the different body parts and had like a functioning like circulatory system. And it took up like a giant studio. It was a circulatory system with tubes that were going through glass things that, you know, glass body parts that she'd created. And I was just like, wow, I totally understand this now. There's research and then there's art. This is part of the art making process. And I just my disbelief before that too was like part of it. I was like, that was like a life changing moment for me. And then, you know, every time that I cried, and I was the worst grad student ever, and I am getting what I gave now.
Well, I think that's a common feeling of all grad students.
Oh, end, my God.
Like, why did I do this? I'm the worst.
Why didn't right? I do this? Why did, yeah. Why did
terrible
I
terrible imposter do syndrome. Like, why am I here? I obviously am underqualified for all of this.
I just, no, but it was so like, just I, yeah. And to go, I'm just, I'm so, I love my experience at U of I. I'm just, and the Japan House and learning tea and just everything about the College of Fine and Applied Arts. I don't even know how, I'm so honored and privileged that I got to go there. That's how I feel. And yeah, and be with you guys. And it was you guys, you know, that helped teach me.
There's something about, like, in the end, I don't think I even got necessarily art out of it. It was more about, like, being able to realize, like, your own bullshit in a way. Like, the critique process is, like, you're not going to get away with bullshitting. Which is, like, that alone is, like, really valuable because it was, like, oh, actually, I need to, like, have justification for what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
And, like, it took a while to get there. It was like, oh, I didn't realize I could just, you know, not phone this in. I have to, like, have a real justification. And then also just, I don't know, just, like, accessing the ability to, like, come up with weird ideas and see them through and figure out, like, did you communicate the idea the way that you had wanted to communicate it? Like, did it work or not? And, like, being, like, having a kind of a safe space to test that. Was really great for me. Like, I feel like it built a ton of confidence. I could go out into the work market and be like, yeah, actually I can, like, do something strange and, like, feel reasonably secure in trying to present it, even if it's bad or it doesn't work out. Like, I've been through that. I know how to do it. It was really valuable.
Yeah. And I tell students, you know, like, so thinking of critique as being this kind of, oh, artsy fartsy kind of thing. And it's the only kind of thing you do in school. And it's like, no, like, if you're going to be a designer or, you know, a creative technologist, you're going to spend the rest of your life justifying why you're right or what you're doing. And the sooner you learn how to do that and are prepared, and I would argue, start building up not just that rationale for why you're doing things, but also the BS, which is like to start talking, to be able to start talking as a reaction when somebody challenges you. And that's what I learned from critique, is not only to justify what I had done that I had already thought through, but when I was put on the spot to start talking and make quick justifications in reaction to things I hadn't even thought of before, which you could say is BS. But for instance, Rose, I call Rose the French lady because she'll make these amazing connections, you know, watch a film and I'll be like, oh, that's a really great film. But then she'll talk about all the metaphors and everything like that. And so I think even if... There's obviously a fine line between bullshit and then just connections, right? And being able to make those connections and that critique process, regardless of whether or not it made you cry and upset.
It was awesome. It was awesome. I should have cried more.
It's good. Yeah. And it's good having a 20-year, has it been 20 years now? It hasn't been that long, but a good, what?
I don't know how long it's been.
Let's not talk about it.
15.
Okay.
15, yeah.
That still seems like a long time. Maybe. But like having a perspective and whatever kind of day-to-day pain that caused, like realizing in retrospect how important that was as training, not just for the arts, but just in terms of being able to function in a complex world and a complex relationships, right?
Yeah. And that whole thing also, like the going through it where you've like cried because it went bad, teaches you like, oh, actually I can't put myself completely into this and have it like emotionally destroy me when someone says my work is bad.
Nice.
Like, it's like, you can only do that a couple of times and you're like, all right, I gotta figure this out because I can't keep walking into rooms and getting like hammered and then going home and questioning my existence. You know, it's like, it's not gonna work. So that's also really important because like in your creative career, like you're gonna not get your way, probably more than you will get your way in the end, unless you're like an independent artist who can go out and just like, you know, do whatever they want and make a bunch of money somehow. But so I don't know. That whole part of it was like really valuable training, I think.
And also, and then like kind of to me, also the magical next step was like being able to absorb that, being able to absorb criticism. And then it helped me because I was older, I think. But then also then being able to filter where it's like, okay, this person, even though they're in a position of authority, right? I'm not going to listen to what they have to say.
Yes, I understand. You can decide, like, actually, I think they're kind of not.
You transcend it. You like at some point. At some point, you go, hey, Yeah,
it's like, I'm gonna pick and choose, and then I'm also going to watch, and then also realizing that sometimes people use, well, this is more specific to critique, is that they're using, it's like mom and dad are arguing, and they're using me as a right. pathway for that, which was something I learned a lot from, and this doesn't happen in our environment that we work in, but yeah. like I could see where it was like, if faculty had issues, sometimes they would use a student's work to battle yeah. each other through that. And that's
I remember really that. That was really uncomfortable, yeah. actually. And also a thing that you run into in the professional world.
Exactly.
Right.
You have,
yeah,
like, you have like
yeah.
stakeholders who disagree with each other and yeah. then they're like getting up in the weeds on your stuff. Yeah.
And you're the yeah, you're just kind of the conduit for that tension.
Yeah, you're like, yeah. could you all just maybe not do this? Yeah. Totally.
So let's just agree that the arts is a fine training for the workplace.
Oh,
you know?
Great training. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Well, the other thing was like 15 years ago, that was it. There was no, you know, like software design wasn't even like a thing. I mean, there was software, but like, I didn't think of that as a career. Like there was no pathway in college to be like, I'm going to go make web apps. You know, like that just wasn't on the table. So that's part of what I've also realized. I had to like hack the educational system to get me to a thing that I wanted to do, which didn't exist. It was weird.
Yeah.
But because you had... somehow through your background and your experience, you had the ability to kind of do that hacking, and that makes you prepared for, you know, an unknown career, the future, right? Where it was like, right. as things move faster and faster, I talk about this all the time. It's like social media management. That wasn't a job, you know, and right. all of a sudden it is. And that's going to keep happening. And it's going to happen faster and faster. It's like all of a sudden these jobs are going to appear, and then they'll age out, disappear, and there'll be a new job. And if you have these technical skills, but also this flexibility and this problem-solving ability, everything we're talking about, you have that weird hybrid. You don't need to know what the future... You kind of know what the future is because you're instinctively going towards that, or not even instinctively, just because of your background. You kind of understand things a little farther out than maybe the average person, right? But it's also, you did not project out 20 years... when you started going to university, right? That, oh, this is where I'm going to be. I'm going to be on a remote, you know, video call talking about my design career in software, right? You didn't exactly. have a plan, but you had this general set of skills and experiences and a way of looking at the world that prepared you for the flexibility to deal with these changes. And then to stand up for things like you're talking about, this sort of more social aspect of it, to say, no, this is an important part of the process.
That's all the stuff that's always made me really afraid to specialize in something. Like I've never been like a specialist. I'm like, which maybe is a result of us going through these like programs where we've like learned the totality of these like complicated problems and how to approach things. That like, I don't want to like put myself in a bucket and be like, I only do that thing, because like, in 5 years, that thing may no longer exist also. So it's like, I don't know, you need to stay a little flexible. Just like,
and you might get bored of that bucket too. It may, the
right,
bucket may still exist, but you may not be interested in that bucket anymore. That bucket, yeah, doesn't change anymore. And you've explored the bucket. You've drained the bucket, right?
you
know, and it's like, I need another bucket.
Yeah.
And people go through that all the time. It's just that if you're equipped for those kind of changes, you're not having a midlife crisis, or you might have a midlife crisis, but at least it won't be around your work or your sort of focus in life. You've got a little more flexibility. All right. Now I'm starting to sound like a salesman.
Really? Is that what you think you sound like?
I feel like I'm selling the fine arts in education,
yes.
right?
Maybe we should critique this. Should we get into a critique?
Yeah, exactly. I say this all the time. Like I say, okay, we're going to talk about your work and everything like that. And I went through a program where people cried. And so that's not going to happen here. You've got it easy. And it's just like, yeah.
I would say you want a 1, 2 or a 3. Like when we went through Taekwondo, the instructor used to, was it Taekwondo? Well, it was Kung Fu, I think. You know, how hard do you want to punch? You know, and then somebody would say 5, and then you punch them really hard. So I've done that before. I've said, do you want a 1, easy critique, a 2, or a 3? You know, give them the choice. And I've, but I don't do critique anymore. I can't stand it. for them. But you know what I enjoy? Like the BFAs, like when they have, we have like a main room and like a main meeting room that's used. It's the old art galleries at ISU, right? So near the end of the semester, there'll be the BFA critique. And you can feel it. You know, people are walking around like, you know, like with their shoulders tense, up. Yeah. Like I love it. It's great. It's not our program. It's like the other program. And I there's food. They always have like a buffet.
They have food here for the students critiquing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's so there's nice. Like a chili and there, you know, it's like a potluck and stuff. There's all this food and you know, I can just go in there and grab some of it and everybody else is walking around angrily. It's awesome. A couple of people are off you see like a group of two people at the end of the hallway and they're talking, you know, like,
animated, like, quiet, whispered, animated discussion. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It's great to have it external, yeah, to sort of, yeah, externally experience that rather than being in the midst of it. So, all right. I feel like, well, we already hit an hour. I feel like we can sort of close this down, but maybe we can talk a little after I shut down the official recording. Yeah. How about that? What do you think? Or did you have a question, Rose?
What can you tell, like, for people who don't know you and don't know your work, what's something that you're really, really proud of, or a couple of things that, you know, like we can say, well, Jonas did this, he did Hello Weather. What implementations or what designs have you made that we can highlight?
Yeah, the two most recent things are Hello Weather and Hey. Hello Weather is a side project I've been running for about 5 years-ish. That's just me and my friend. And we kind of turned it into a reasonably legitimate side business to the extent that you can do one of those with like a weather app, because they're not exactly like paying out all kinds of money from a weather app. But it's a thing that I did all the design for everything, the website, the ads, the app itself, the interface. So that one's a good example of kind of my sensibility. And then Hey, actually, I'd kind of been working on and off for years prior to us actually building it. We had like prototyped it in a couple of different ways a few years back, and then finally came back around and realized like, oh, this is a thing maybe we want to do. So I kind of got to work on that like from its very inception, and then see it all the way through to the production version. And so that has like the most of my kind of hands on it of any of the Basecamp products, like by far, because I was really heavily involved in the whole thing.
Can you say, what does it do? What is it?
Hey is a sort of reimagined email service. So like instead of using Gmail, you would use Hey. And we kind of went into it originally thinking of communication problems for a business related to email. So the things we were encountering were like, we would have people like a benefits administrator who would be doing all sorts of things with like external vendors, and all of that work was happening over email. But then if that person like went on maternity leave, like there was no way to sort of like hand that work off to someone else and like keep it going, because like it's all sort of like saved away in email somewhere. And the only way to like get it out is to go back through it and like forward 500 emails. Like it's like gross. So we started in that sort of problem and kind of figured out some ideas, and then realized that we had more ideas. And if we really wanted to do something around it, we would probably need to run our own email like from top to bottom, because it'd be too hard to do it like on a client. So then we were like, well, okay, if we're going to do that, I guess we might as well make like a personal email system and just like really go for it. So we did, and then started looking at like every annoyance of email. I mean, people hate email for a bunch of reasons. And so we tried to like look at hacks that people do and really get into like the details of like, why are all of these things bad and what can we do instead? So the totality of the product is like a reaction to all the problems with email and trying to like reimagine that in a new way.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I missed out on the release of that, but it's totally, in my nerd area. So I'm going to have to at least check it out and see it. I just recently split myself into my work Outlook and then my Gmail for everything else. And so I'm in the process of separating, right, and creating these two worlds and two methods of, you know, dealing with email. And it's like, oh, I should have tried this out.
I just recently was gifted with, I don't know how many, like with 5 years of emails that the previous director of our program sent and received. So
wow.
Like 20 or 30 folders full of Outlook emails archived just for me in case I ever need to look back on that. So it's
how would you even know what's in there or how to even search through it? I mean, when someone else's email, it seems so difficult. Like, I don't know what's in here.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I guess keyword search. Yeah.
I haven't opened it yet, but I did. I asked him a question. I was like, hey, how did you handle this back like 3 years ago? And he was like, it's in the email. Just go unarchive it. And like, I'm like, yeah.
That's a scary answer.
Absolutely not.
Lots of stuff's in the email, man.
I will not do that. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to, it's over an hour. I think this is good.
Okay.
Cool. I'm going to play the outro music and then maybe we'll talk a little bit after that.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you so much, Jonas. This was great.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks for humoring us and thanks for being a part of this. Best of luck. It's not luck. I'm excited to see where you go next. Because it's going to be fascinating and interesting and I'm very excited. So thank you for talking with us today about
Thanks for having me on. It was super cool to talk to you guys.
Yeah. Thank you.